Welcome, ladies and gents. It's Tamara Mercica here from gettingnaked.com.au, where we strip back the layers on love, life, and relationships so you can enjoy a deeper self-love. And today, I'm really excited to have an old friend and colleague here to chat about our return to food. Sherry Strong is a food philosopher, a nutritional strategist. She's a chef, the curator and co-founder of the World Wellness Project, the former Victorian Chair of Nutrition Australia, among many other prestigious titles. And today we're here to talk about food. So thank you, Sherry, for taking the time to share your insights and wisdom.
My pleasure, Tamara.
So I suppose I'd just love to start with you sharing what it was that led to your passion with food and I suppose just a healthier way of living.
I think with most experts, our expertise tends to come out of our wounds and our pain. And I think from early childhood, I was actually, I know as a baby, I was malnourished and I was also fed what I refer to as this lethal recipe of highly refined sugars, oils, salts, grains and chemicals in the form of baby formula in the 60s. That's what it was made out of. And it's set up for nutritional deficiencies and then a childhood of low self-esteem, set up for body image issues, which was the perfect kind of recipe for becoming twice my size at one point in my life where I was literally double my size. And I realized that diets didn't actually work. And so it really was a journey and a process of discovery as to what actually does work. And I was a chef in Melbourne. I started as a chef in 91 and opened a cooking school called the Food Lovers Workshop in 93. And then got into kind of more the health and well-being side of things and ended up leaving Australia 3 years ago after 22 years there and returning to Canada where, I'm now doing the same thing, teaching at the Institute of Holistic Nutrition and my own Holistic Culinary Academy and online programs. So that's kind of the trajectory of what happened and where I am.
Yeah. So you mentioned just early on that you were malnourished as a child and, the formula that we're fed as a child, it really just doesn't support us in, I suppose, growing healthy and strong and having a really good mental well-being as well. Can you just explain a little bit more about that? Because I know as a child I was on formula as well and I know that I've had to go through quite a similar journey. There was depression, there was body image issues, there was, body not absorbing nutrients properly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What we know of nature is a very small amount of what actually goes on, and certainly back then even less so. In fact, now we're discovering that just by going through the birth canal, there are literally thousands of ways, biochemically and physically, that the body actually adjusts and prepares itself for life outside of the womb. And so babies who are actually, removed from the mother's womb by a C-section actually miss out on that. We start to develop our taste preferences in the womb. We can tell that we have a preference for sweet and based on what our mother eats, we're actually starting to be nourished. So if your mother or you as a mother, carrying a child aren't actually nourishing your body, the baby will take what it can in form of nutrients, but there's a limitation of what it can take in. And so this kind of, we see this set up for a nourished body down the track right from conception. So the quality of the semen and the ovaries, which is constructed from the foods, the quality of foods we eat actually determines the health of that embryo. And then once the baby's actually born, these baby formulas cannot possibly come close to mother's milk. They're very crude, rudimentary formulations that try to mimic mother's milk, but there's literally thousands of phytonutrients, within the mother's milk that a formula cannot possibly replicate. And yet when I was born, my mother was convinced by doctors and nurses because they had said, we've actually improved on breast milk. This is better than what you can give your child. And what it was, and still there's many baby formulas today that have refined sugar in them. They have refined oils, they have refined salts, they have refined grains and legumes, even soy products, which we would never see, human baby in nature suckling off of any kind of soy plant. And then they have, all these chemicals or synthesized vitamins. And even the best of formulas cannot possibly even come close to mother's milk. But the worst thing in certainly the older baby formulas and some of the cruder ones today is that they have things like refined sugar in it, which sets up. And if you look at how refined sugar is actually made, it's very similar to to taking poppy sap from a opium poppy and turning it into heroin. So these are the refined sugars that are actually in our diet. So we're literally setting our babies up for serious sugar addiction all their life. And now we're starting to see that, you know, sugar, refined sugar, lights up the brain in the same way that cocaine and heroin light up the brain, right? And so they're made in very similar processes, and wonder why our children, you know, have these, you know, incredible strong addictions to refined sugar. And I know I was as a child, and I've worked with children, and I can actually see behavioral differences time and time again once a child is actually fed something with what I call this lethal recipe. Literally within minutes of eating the food, I'll start to see huge behavioral, you know, shifts and reactions, whether it's, you know, depression or hyperactivity or complete acting out and tantrums. And what happens is, if, you know, you just kind of get used to it, you don't even notice that it's the food that's actually producing that. And so these poor children, you know, they have little bodies. If you can imagine how, you know, how it affects you when you have some sugar, it's just like, whoa. And you imagine, you know, a quarter of that body weight trying to absorb that sugar and deal with it in a way, you know. Emotional intelligence is a big ask for a child.
Yeah, and I certainly understand what you mean about the addiction, because I was a huge sweet tooth till probably about 5 years ago, I think. And when I stopped having refined sugar, it, you know, you sort of felt those withdrawal symptoms, and it wasn't until maybe a good 6-12 months without having refined sugar on a daily basis that all of a sudden I went, I don't actually need it anymore. So I suppose that was a big realization for me as well. So when you say addiction, it just makes so much sense.
It does.
So I suppose what I want to ask is, what is eating well? Because there's certainly a lot of misinformation out there about what's good for us, what's not. You know, how can people cut through the crap, so to speak, so that they know what they're putting in their body is actually good for them?
And there is, you're right, Tamara, there's tons of what I call information, that nutritional marketing, that actually ends up leading to nutritional confusion, where one day you hear that soy is this wonder food, it's going to solve all your nutritional problems. And the next day you hear that it's really bad for you and it's going to harm your baby, and you just left kind of thinking, well, what the hell do I feed myself? And when I started looking at this question, because at the time when I started studying this question, this was in the mid-90s, I was the Victorian Chair of Nutrition Australia, and I would see these clinical journals, Asia-Pacific clinical journals of nutrition, that would have these credible peer-reviewed studies, you know, information that was released that often contradicted each other. And I'm thinking, well, as, you know, being in this position of, you know, authority on some level, I'm thinking, well, if I am confused by this, how does the average person who has a whole family and a career and all these other things, how do they actually figure this out? It's insane. So I started, I do a lot of, you know, my contemplation and my, I believe I access, you know, that external, genius. That comes through me in nature. And I was out walking one day, and it was like I could see this visualization of kind of these steps of nature, that nature actually tells us what it is that we're meant to eat and the quantities, you know, and how easily it's obtained in nature, and when it's obtained in nature, you know, seasonally, you know, amounts. So that which is most abundant in nature, we're meant to have most of. And if it's harder to obtain in nature, we're meant to have less of it. And nature actually gives us stronger desires to actually obtain these foods because they're harder to obtain. So that stronger desire means we'll actually work harder for it. And then this balance thing that happens in nature is that the harder you're working for it, you work off the energy, because these harder to obtain foods are usually higher in energy. Right. And so the third area is, if you cannot get it in nature, not only do you not need it, it's harmful to the body and the environment. And that's actually, you know, what most countries now that are adopting this lethal recipe and the lifestyle diseases are reflecting, that is, they're eating from that area of most of their food that's on their table, that they eat out and on driveways, is actually something you could never actually replicate in nature. Yes. And it's, you know, it's made with the, in the process, how you actually make the lethal recipe ingredients, which we do this to many ingredients, but the five kind of main ones, groups of ingredients, are refined sugars, refined oils, refined salts, refined grains, and refined chemicals. All of those things you'll find initially in nature, but the processes in which they actually go through to bring them to your table are, as I said, very similar to taking the poppy sap and turning it into heroin, the coca leaf and turning it into cocaine. Coca leaves in their natural state, when you chew on them, they give you this lovely little kind of skip in your step like a cup of coffee, but they're not highly addictive or toxic. Opium sap, when you dry it and grind it and sprinkle it into teas as they do in during funerals in Iran to help with the grieving process, not highly addictive or toxic. But then when you start to cook these things, like the sugars, you know, like the oils, you know, in our diet, and they do this with salts too, and many of the chemicals, they start to cook it. And they start to remove the macro and micronutrients, the vitamins, minerals, and phytochemicals. Just like if you imagine someone cooking a stock on the stove and they're taking off what we call the scum, or impurities is also called in cookery terms. But the truth is that's where a lot of the nutrients are. And the same thing happens when they're actually going through the process of refining the oils and sugars in particular. Because what it does is those macro and micronutrients are also living things that are nourishing, and nourishing things in nature also they go off, particularly, you know, the vitamins and the phytochemicals. Mm-hmm. And so by removing them, they can actually increase the shelf life, and increase profits. And so the process of heat denatures them, removing of the macro and micronutrients, and there are toxic chemicals that are routinely used to actually break down the structure of the plant or the substances used, so they can actually go through processes of extraction. So from opium sap to opium, you have a toxic addictive substance. And when you take those processes and take them even further, and do more of them, higher heats, more toxic chemicals, more stages of removal, so you end up with a pure white substance, you end up with something that's highly addictive and toxic. And so what's happening now is we have like sugars, oils, salts, grains, and chemicals in lots of foods. And so in a small amount, as say we did 100 years ago, had maybe 2 pounds over a year, the body could actually handle that. And also it was much harder and more expensive to obtain than it is now. And here it's everywhere. It's in everything. And the average, you know, teenager is consuming about 150 pounds of sugar. You know, that's like 70 kilos of sugar. And so what it does is it not just, you know, sends us on a bit of a loopy bend with the blood sugar high and then the ensuing low. It really taxes the pancreas, you know, by, you know, causing it, you know, overtaxing its production of insulin. And it will also strip nutrients from our bodies. So high sugar consumption will strip nutrients from your body, so that when you are even consuming healthy foods, it's actually, you know, they're actually being taken out. So, and there's numerous things, you know, if you look at a book that was written many years ago, Lick the Sugar Habit by Nancy Appleton, we can see so far she's tabulated over 140 diseases that are, and conditions that are directly related to high sugar consumption.
It's so scary when you think about how many people just grab food on the run, you know, those packaged whatevers,
yes.
And that's what they're feeding and fueling themselves with. And you mentioned earlier also, which I remember seeing in one of your talks years ago, that, you know, the harder it is to get something from nature, the less of it we should be eating. And the thing that I suppose resonated with me back then was nuts, because, you know, you've got to take the shells off, which is quite a tedious task. And I used to eat like bags of nuts back then. So that was sort of like a big wake up call for me. So I suppose, can you expand a little bit on, you know, I suppose some of those foods that we should be eating a little less of, even though they are coming from nature?
Yes. So something pretty basic, you know, I start to ask people, as far as understanding how nature would provide for us, the consumption concept, which is one of the philosophies I talk about in my book and my online program, is how would you actually eat if you had to source things in nature? So just like the nuts, you know, like when I first started making almond milk, I would say to people, you know, I remember the first time peeling my first almond, which was a beautiful family in Kingsville had an almond tree in their backyard, and I remember peeling the first one. It took me 10 minutes to peel the first one, right? And so I'm thinking, well, imagine getting enough to make a cup, you know, of almonds so that you could actually then make almond milk, right? And then, you know, making it in a blender is very different than making it by hand. And so it's just starting to help us understand that the resources that are required by the earth to produce something, the human resources that are required to gather it, there's a similar correlation between the resources within the body to actually assimilate and break it down, right? And so we're eating now super complex foods that, even if they're natural, the body still has to assimilate all those ingredients, and it can be quite taxing. So but it can be even just for like simple things. When I ask people, what would you prefer for dinner? And if they're not vegetarian and I give them the choice between chicken or an omelet, most people go chicken. And the stats are backing that up, because the average Australian is consuming over 50 kilograms of chicken a year. And that's just chicken alone. And it's higher in Canada and the United States. Mm-hmm. But if you give the same choice in nature and you say you have to go out into the natural environment and choose your dinner, would you prefer an omelet or a chicken? You know, the thought of getting an egg versus catching, killing, plucking, disemboweling, bleeding, you know, and preparing a chicken, most people would become vegetarian. And even if they're not vegetarian, they would be thinking about, oh, chicken producing lots of eggs ongoing or one meal. And I remember recently I shared this story with one of my students from Kenya. And she said, this is right, you know, my family are chicken farmers in Kenya. And she said, you know, it takes us a long time to catch a chicken. It takes us, it can take up a half hour to kill it, you know, and even longer to then bleed it and pluck it. And even then, when we do kill a chicken, we will actually invite our neighbors and share it, you know, as part of a meal. So, and we do this every 4 to 6 weeks. This is not, you know, a daily or even a weekly occurrence, and they're chicken farmers, right? So when we actually have to gather something ourselves or make a decision about consuming it, we have a very different relationship with that food when we are involved in the growing or the gathering or the processing. And there's just things that we would never ever consider doing if we had to do it ourselves. So if you think about the typical oils in the clear glass bottles or plastic bottles on your supermarket shelf, including what we call pure olive oil, have been exposed to things like heptane and hexane and high heats and water and phosphoric acid, which is a highly corrosive substance, and sodium chloride, which sodium hydroxide is caustic soda, you know, and then a whole host of synthetic antioxidants, activated, clays for bleaching, and you know, just kind of an oil can go through 14 different processes, and in nature you would never even consider doing that, you know. Getting the oil in the first place would, you know, be enough work to, you know, to grind something to the point where it is. So what's happened now is, when we've abdicated responsibility for our food and eating and everyone else is preparing our food, we've lost complete connection with what's going on with it. And what's further happened is, because we've lost connection, we don't appreciate the efforts that's required to produce these foods. And so if you don't value another person's time in producing the food, you just say, well, you know, I really want it cheaply. You know, I want to get that cheap and I want it fast. And that disconnection is really our disconnection with nature, that is a disconnection with the very thing that nourishes, energizes, and protects our body. So our role and our job is to reconnect with nature. And one of the best ways to do it, rather than, I'm not suggesting we're all going to go into the forest and live off of twigs and, you know, and nettles and, you know, and things like that, although we'd probably be healthier. It's a hard life, right? But we need to actually get our thinking correctly. We need to develop, a more in-tune consciousness around our food and eating than what we presently have on mass.
It's really easy to, I suppose, get stuck in the hustle and bustle of life and put the priority on so many other things instead of bringing it back to what we're putting in our body. And I suppose, you know, Hippocrates once said, you know, let food be thy medicine. And from my experience, you know, food can really be used to heal us, because essentially it is our fuel, and we run better when the fuel is of a higher quality. So you know, what you're saying, it just makes sense as to why there is so much illness out there when we're putting this rubbish in our body. So I suppose, you know, can you expand a little bit on the direct correlation between, you know, what we input into our body and the diseases and illnesses that can come about from that?
Yes, if you have a moment, if you're ever able to Google the Center of Disease Control obesity slides, it's probably one of the best physical representations of what's actually happening. And they collected data over, the slides I used were just from 1985 to 2000, so just within 15 years. You could actually see the control group, indicative of the whole population, become significantly fatter just within 15 years. So they moved from less than 10% fat to over 30%, which turns them into the obese category, right? Or puts them in the obese category. So this is not something that's actually happened genetically. You know, this is purely environmental to have something that happens so quickly. If it was evolutionary or genetically, it would actually happen over many, many years. And what happened is we, particularly in the 80s, we introduced things like high fructose corn syrup. And we started to process more and more, and we started to put more chemicals into our food. And then these foods, because every time you take it a step away from nature, it becomes that more compelling to the body, because the body actually wants more of it to make up for the nutrients lost through heat and denaturing, right? So then what happens is we crave more of the food. It creates a toxic environment in the body. It's addictive. We feel crappy afterwards. And when we're feeling crappy and low, the body has this interesting overcompensation factor. So like when you have something really sugary, it doesn't send usually just enough insulin. It sends, overcompensates with the insulin and then pushes your blood sugar down, right? So then you actually feel this low. So we're left in this place of feeling really, really low. And when you're feeling really low, chances are if you're given the option of, you know, chips and ice cream versus the bowl of broccoli, when we're feeling low, it's not like, I just need some raw broccoli right now because my boyfriend's broken up with me, right? You know,
give me the chocolate.
Exactly. We choose the something that gives us this overcompensation for the low that we're actually feeling, you know. So we're very strongly physiologically, you know, driven beings. And if we're not eating with consciousness, we don't even understand, like, we're just, you know, I'm a really smart person. Why am I eating this food I know is not good for me, right? So we have to actually, you know, start to nourish our bodies, and nourishment needs to come not just in the form of physical food, but the work that I've been doing with clients, and the reason why, you know, I've been basically having the levels of success I've having is because I've stopped just talking about food, and I've moved into this concept I teach called hypernourishment, where we start to learn where we have toxicity in our mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical world, start to work at removing that, seeing where the malnourishment is in our mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical world. And then we start to look at where we can actually bring nourishment in, and even hypernourishment in, you know, stepping it up a level. So not just looking at vegetables, but then looking at organic and biodynamic vegetables, and then looking at more nutrient-dense vegetables, and all the while trying to incorporate this in ways that are actually softer, more gentle, gracious, kind, delicious, you know, and in very much a loving approach. So the diet mentality is very restrictive. It's prescriptive. It historically, it's been about go hard. You know, it's been very masculine in its approach. And it's also been very unnatural. So there's, you know, an animal in nature doesn't go, oh no, I had 3 blueberries yesterday. I don't think I can have, you know, another 4 today. It doesn't measure. It just, it doesn't even think about what it needs. It just works instinctually and intuitively. And it's drawn naturally to what it needs and what nourishes it. Kinesthetically, it knows this. And it's repelled by the things that, you know, it doesn't need. And we forget that we were actually originally an animal. We still are, but we've lost that connection with our nature, and we've lost a kind of, we now have a mistrust of our own intuition, because remember when I talked about in that middle group that things that are harder to obtain in nature were given stronger physiological desires for. In nature, it worked out perfectly because if we wanted extra nuts, we worked our butts off to get the extra nuts, right? So there was this balance. Today, if we want extra nuts, we don't literally do not have to move. We can actually have one of those little roller chairs that we, you know, push the button and it takes us to a front door and we just, you know, press something on the computer and it actually can be delivered, what would take us weeks to obtain in nature, it can be delivered to our doors without any effort expended. So we've lost that natural connection. And so getting back to it, we really kind of need to get the mindset right, get the heart set right, and get quiet time and learn to reconnect and listen to our body and to hone that intuition and instinct that is part of our natural animal.
I work with a lot of women, especially to help them develop their relationship with food, because as I'm sure you're aware, eating disorders, whether they be mild or severe forms, they just wreak havoc on your life. Mm-hmm. And what I found is ultimately an eating disorder comes from a lack of self-love. So Absolutely. Many people eat to fill a perceived void. Yet once you're actually able to fill that mental void, once you feel complete and whole in yourself, once you have that self-love, then the eating disorders and the negative feelings towards food actually clear up. So has this been your experience with the clients that you've been working with?
Oh, absolutely. And that's where, you know, for years I was working, giving people, you know, prescriptive kind of, you know, information about nutrition and wondering why it didn't really stick. You know, and it's, you know, it's the classic thing. It's why diets don't work is because they're working on the surface stuff. And until you actually go underneath and you start to work at the drivers, you know, what actually drives our relationship with food and our food choices, you know, and so often, even if it's not in the situation of having, you know, an eating disorder, like, you know, a clearly diagnosable eating disorder, but the stress eating and how much we eat just out of fear, right? As opposed to, you know, how many decisions in our life and how our whole kind of world is really setting out to perpetuate fear instead of love. You know, look at the entertainment on television, reading the news, you know, as Brene Brown, it's the news is all about finding out who's responsible for all the wrongs, you know, what's going wrong in the world and who's responsible for it. And, you know, all this collectively, you know, plus the, you know, increased demands on our time with, you know, the computer and all the social media that it, you know, kind of sends up to and, you know, the expectations we have to be perfect physically, mentally, you know, professionally, you know, our relationships have to be awesome. And it's just completely overwhelming. And so, that whole place of kind of, let's get back to homeostasis, right? What do I need, you know, to actually survive, you know, and thrive and have a happy life? And you start to cut through that whole expectation and acquisition, you know, that whole thing, and just really strip it back. And even if I look at the correlation between the food that I encourage people to eat, it's very simple. You know, we don't have to have a 3-course meal every night. You know, you can have 3 things on your plate, literally, you know, 3 basic ingredients can make a fabulous meal. So it's simplicity is really the key to a lot of those things. And as you said, definitely going to that place of self-love. And that's, you know, if you think about it, the return to food, the book I've written, Return to Food, the Life-Changing Anti-Diet, I really talk about changing your life. And then the food takes care of itself, just as you said, that because you're taking care of the drivers that actually propel you or motivate you to make certain food choices.
That's certainly been my experience, because I know when I, you know, I sort of came into this line of work more from the mental perspective, because I had depression and I was a binge eater. And, you know, I used to do the herbal teas to get the food out of my body when I'd eaten too much. And it was the more that I stripped back the mental and emotional programming that had actually created that need to overeat, that I actually just started being drawn to good foods. And, you know, obviously I started to educate myself more and I started eating organic. And like when you said, you know, just having a couple of things on your plate, if it's organic food, there's so much flavor in it compared to the types of, you know, veggies and things that you'll get from a supermarket. You don't need to add all of these extra preservatives and bits and pieces just to make food taste good. When you go organic, it's just, it's yummy.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, I know it's not just about the quality of the food that we put in our bodies. It's how we eat that's actually important too. So can you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, certainly a big part of what's actually happening now is we're eating more and more meals on the run, eating more meals alone, eating more meals in front of a computer or a television. So there's really a disconnect between what it is we're actually eating and the connection between where our food has come from. So we're actually meant to eat together. As a species, we are actually meant to eat together. So sharing a meal is absolutely, integral to developing that healthy relationship with food. And if you live alone, it doesn't actually preclude you from eating all your meals, alone. You can actually find people to eat dinner with. You can invite people over. You can go out. There's social ways of actually sharing a meal. There's also the aspect of actually really understanding what's in your food, developing a relationship with your food from actually doing something like going to the farmer's market, procuring your food, asking and talking about your food from the farmer. And even if you're not doing that, but actually creating your own food and creating it from scratch, again, it's all leading up to how we actually eat and then eating. And then if we actually eat together, and a big part of that is to start to eat in a conscious, mindful way. So initially, just actually giving thanks for the food, that nourishes, energizes, and protects your body. Give thanks, to the farmers who actually, taken risks, worked through all kinds of horrendous weather, heat or rain or cold, to actually make sure that you actually have that food. And if they've farmed organically, they've worked even harder and taken more risks. And then it is a process of actually tasting the flavors, smelling their aromas, feeling the textures in your mouth. And if you're eating with your hands, which does increase our satiety by actually eating with your hands, it's shown to improve the flavor of food. Don't suggest this in a posh restaurant with the soup.
Oh, I love eating with food. It's with hands. It's great.
Yeah. So those kinds of things it's just, that kind of mindfulness. And the interesting thing is that your body is, as I said, you're an animal, so it has powerful kinesthetic abilities. And we can actually tell, even without touching something, even just by looking at it, we can tell whether something's organic or conventional. And this work, when we come to it with consciousness, Dr. David Hawkins has written a fabulous book called Power Versus Force, The Hidden Determinants of Human Behavior. And he can actually, strength test and has shown with thousands of people over 25 years that when an organic apple and a conventional apple is held up in front of an audience, when they're tested with the organic apple, their arm is actually stronger. And when they're tested with the conventional apple, it's weaker. So we actually have this knowing, and it's about stripping back and actually taking the time and prioritizing what's truly, truly important in our lives. And we've kind of lost that nourishment, that connecting to our food is actually primary for our well-being, quality of life and longevity.
So being more present as opposed to, I suppose, living in the future and thinking of the next thing and then rushing food down.
Mm. Yes.
And I did read in one book that you should chew every mouthful 50 times. And my partner and I decided to take on this little challenge, and we did it for a full day and just went, oh my gosh, this is really time consuming. But I suppose, what are your thoughts on chew? How many times should we be chewing?
Yeah, one thing that I've been big on my work is not shooting on anyone, right? Okay, so
yeah.
Even if you look at animals, who are eating a big, mouthful of grass, they're not always going to chew 50 times for every blade of grass or whatever, every mouthful of grass, right? So there's a lot of people have these ideas. And yes, chewing it does do a lot for food. And yes, we are not chewing our food enough, but if we're actually chewing it till there's an expression, you should actually drink your solids and chew your liquids. Okay, so and it's just in both parts of it is just kind of be more mindful of actually chewing, but it's that hurried, it's not being present. So if you're just chewing your food till it's easily digestible, that's good. You don't have to actually I'd probably get through, if I had to do that I'd probably be eating an ounce or two of food for every meal.
Yeah.
And to me, you know what it also does is, it takes it out of that natural way of being around food, and then it turns it into a should, and it's fairly prescriptive, and it takes the pleasure out of food. And food's not just meant to be about nutrients. It's not just meant to be about pleasure. And that reductionist kind of either or is really what's gotten us into this place of disordered eating and unnatural, unhealthy relationship with food. Food is so much more. And when we start to take it in as a species, one of the things that it's absolutely beautiful about being a human is that we get to enjoy food on many, many levels. I've often joked about people who are breatharians. And for those of you who don't know what a breatharian is, they're people who actually subsist without even the consumption of water. So they just get all their nutrients from the air. Highly controversial. But I often laugh thinking, you know, of this kind of scenario in heaven where, you know, they've gone up to heaven and so going through their CV down on earth, and someone's saying, it's one of the angels is saying, so you were breatharian. And they're like, yeah, well, that's a really interesting choice, breatharian. You do realize that the food is one of the main reasons people actually go to earth, go down to earth, you know, that kind of thing. You know, so certainly understand and admire people who are kind of taking that whole spiritual aspect around food. But for me, for this life, I'm a spiritual being in a physical body going through life on the planet. And, you know, 80 years, if you do it right, is good enough for me. But I really want to enjoy that physical experience. And that is a marriage of finding the true pleasure of food, of eating food that tastes good while I'm eating it, after I've eaten it, when the next morning when I wake up. And it does include things like chocolate for me. I'd rather live to 80 with chocolate than 100 without chocolate, right? So we get to make our choices. And if you can connect more with nature, the great thing is that you don't have to miss out. So where when I was a kid and I would love a Cadbury's chocolate, now I can't even get one bite down because to me it just tastes like pure sugar. Mm. And like yesterday I had a friend over and we made vegan chocolate brownies. Now this is a recipe that I came up with that is just amazing. And as a chef, if you had told me as a chef when I was in the heyday of my cooking career that this brownie was vegan, it was gluten-free, it was egg-free, it was had no refined sugars in it, it's just completely natural, and it tastes so good. Even when you taste the batter, it actually tastes like, you know, one of the most indulgent cookie doughs. So this is a truly, you know, healthy brownie, and there's just no downside to actually what's in it. And so you don't actually have to miss out the experience of actually eating close to nature, relatively close, you know. Minimally processed food, seasonal, organic, and whole food can be a truly pleasurable, delicious experience.
It's certainly been my experience because I cook with all organics and no refined sugar, and I love desserts. And it's been really interesting because sometimes you take a dessert round to a friend's place, and what I've found is you can't generally eat as much of a really yummy, nutritious dessert as you would of something else.
Yes.
And you're left feeling satisfied and fulfilled, and, you know, people would have no idea that it's actually completely good for you. So it's been quite a surprise to other people to, I suppose, experience that sort of nutrition in such a indulgent way.
It is, and it's surprising. You know, I often we'll have people over for dinner and I never mention if anything's gluten-free, or, you know, I just don't mention those things unless someone has some kind of allergy or intolerance. And people have left my house, you know, for many years and gone, oh, that meal was vegetarian. Are you vegetarian? No. They didn't actually notice until it was finished, you know, because it was so satisfying. And I wasn't drawing attention to it, you know. I saw a great cartoon in the New Yorker recently, and it's got these two girls sitting at lunch, and the one girl says to the other one, she says, you know, I've been gluten-free for just a week, or only a week, and I'm already really annoying. So it's just, you know, that whole kind of dietary, you know, we draw attention to ourselves through what we're eating, and, you know, if we just kind of relax and get into the joy and rather than shoulding, what we should be eating, what we should, you know, should and shouldn't be eating. It's, I think that's where we create a really unhealthy culture around it. And it's also why, you know, a lot of health food people, you know, repel people, or that, you know, their social life is limited in that sense, or rather embracing what it is they do feel like eating or what they do want, what makes their body feel good. One of my friends, Muriel Hemingway, who's written the foreword for the book, one of the things I loved about her relationship around food, and she's had, you know, disordered eating and tried every fad diet around. But when she's offered alcohol, or she's offered chocolate, or, you know, something with refined sugar in it, she's just like, no, that stuff makes me crazy. You know, so she's not making anyone else feel bad. She's actually saying, you know, when I put that in my body, I feel crazy. And that's not how I want to feel. You know, but she just says, no, don't want it. That makes me crazy. And it can be as simple as that. You don't have to make anyone feel bad for their food choices, or the fact that you're not choosing it.
Sherry, I love your approach on everything, and I think everyone's going to get so much value out of what you've shared. But is there anything else that you wanted to offer?
Oh, well, I do have, there's a website called returntofood.com, and there are recipes and videos on that website. And I also have an hour long, talk that I gave. It's actually a webinar, at returntofood.tv. So returntofood.com and .tv. You'll find lots of things, resources, blogs, recipes, videos, you know, and bits and pieces that further the philosophy.
Beautiful. Thank you so, so much. I've learnt heaps today, which has been fantastic. And, yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat.
Awesome. I'm completely honored and love that you've invited me to have a chat.
Thank you. To everyone else, this has been Sherry Strong. I'm Tamara Mersica. Thanks for taking the time to enjoy today's delicious offerings. And if you would like to learn more about how to develop your relationship with you, simply visit gettingnaked.com.au or Sherry's site, returntofood.com.